Buddha taught
for our day-to-day lives. And last week we talked about the tools that are available for dealing with anxiety. This week I'm going to talk about spiritual tools that help with long-term interpersonal relationships. Doesn't have to mean romantic relationships. It could also be just relationships with parents, siblings, children, relationships with people we live with, roommates, friends. Co-workers, especially people who we have to work with for long periods of time. It's, of course, a topic that becomes increasingly difficult as we live more and more in a post-industrial, service-oriented economy that's completely based around the ideas of convenience and disposability. Convenience and disposability. That's what somebody once said, that Manhattan and New York was a city of individuals living in millions of one-bedroom apartments, each person with their own little kingdom. Sometimes we share and have roommates, but then we have our own rooms. We all have our own little kingdoms, which is all exactly the way we want it. And we're used to having our food delivered and everything delivered in the moment, and we have clothes built to meet every new trend, but not built to last. Clothes that's built to just last a season, and then we throw it away. Food and canisters that we throw away immediately after eating. Furniture that's meant to look good, but not meant to last. It's a very disposable culture and a very convenient one. And we're not used to, certainly, increasingly also the long-term commitments of families become increasingly disrupted by what used to be, for example, families used to live with each other for long extended periods of time. Increasingly, that's not the case anymore, and when people grow old, they're ferreted away first into assisted living facilities and then to nursing homes. So there's this thematic, and then also look at the realm of jobs, which used to, of course, not so long ago, be long-term commitments. Now most places I work at as freelance, you go there, you go away for 6 months, and then you come back and everybody's changed. There's nobody, like, where did everybody go? And it's increasingly, people view staying at a job for a year as a, wow, I lasted a year there. So that fucking corporate cubicle where they walled me in. So anyway, you get the idea. It's very much a disposable, convenient society with very little reward for commitment. So within this context, how do we develop the tools to allow us to have skillful, wholesome relationships with others over a long period of time? Especially this goes for friendships and romantic relationships, where at the very beginning, the mind, when there's a new person or new object in our lives, the mind rewards us by flooding the frontal lobe with dopamine, adrenaline, testosterone, estrogen, excitatory neurotransmitters, which are basically reward. Is that the excitation? What are they? Excitatory hormones and neurotransmitters that are basically reward-oriented. Unfortunately, this very powerful and potent and wonderful situation is transient. It lasts for a very short period of time, just like our short-term interests and convenience. So is the brain very short-term in its release of reward chemicals for novelty, for new things in our lives. And pretty soon, after about a month or 6 weeks, we look at the person we've been sleeping with, or the new friend, or the new colleague, and suddenly they're not so perfect anymore. Actually, all that's happened is there's a different brain chemistry going on in your brain. They probably haven't changed at all. You just begin to notice all the, as Ajahn Brahm says, the monk, he talks about the brick wall, and at first you might just see this beautiful brick wall, but then over time you start to see the little bricks that are at a bad angle, or were installed a little bit, or are slightly discolored. They were there all the time, but at the beginning we just don't see them. So the very first of the tools I'll talk about, and I'm going to go run through them because there's a whole bunch. The first is sadha, which by the Buddha meant commitment. And the idea is that the good things in life are things that may not feel that great in the short term, but in the long term, they release or they create wholesome, happy, peaceful, tranquil, or positive states. And the early, for example, in romantic relationships, the early lust, once it goes away, is replaced by serotonin and oxytocin and very, very subtler non-reward, or they are reward, but they're very subtle neurotransmitters. So we suddenly go from this very powerful drugged out states, the beginning where the rest of the world blurs out and we're unaware of how shitty our lives are, how difficult our jobs are, how much we're irritated by, how much we're fearful about money, because I'm in a new relationship, it's so great. It's so great. I'm getting laid, it's wonderful. It's wonderful that the world has vanished into a blur of okayness. And then suddenly the world, poof, it's back. Oh, shit. And it must be their fault. It's just not the one. I thought it was the one. A month ago, I was sure it was the one, but it's not the one. It's just not the one. She's not the one. He's not the one. This job's not the one. This living situation's not the one. This friend's not the one. They're all not the one. So, and even luckily, the brain does have a second set that rewards us for hanging in there. And there's also another tool in the brain called the striatum, which is known as the part of the brain that's habit, that records our habits. And that's good, because the striatum is the thing that allows us to do habits that really don't feel that good in the short term. I'll give you my favorite example, flossing my teeth. Took me years to get that habit, but one thing I discovered was that if I did it for 3 weeks, just forced myself to do it for 3 weeks, eventually the striatum, after about 3 weeks through the process you all know as neuroplasticity, that's right off the tip of your tongues, that part of the brain starts expecting me to floss my teeth every night. And even though I really don't enjoy the sensation, it will not allow me to fall asleep without doing it. So we can actually trick the brain into building habits that don't feel that good in the short term, that aren't rewarding in the short term, but in the long term are rewarding. That's why if you want to develop a meditation practice for 3 weeks, listen to online a guided meditation. And once you've done it for about 3 weeks every day, in the fourth week, you'll start to get a little bit of a trigger in the cingulate and in the other parts of the brain, the striatum, saying, hey, there's something wrong, I didn't meditate today. So we actually can take advantage of the mind's habitual driven nature to overwhelm its desire for short-term satisfaction. We can actually trick the brain into doing something that it's not set up to do. So the trick with developing commitment is to practice in the rest of our lives doing things that in the short term aren't that much fun, but in the long term are good and healthy and positive to us. For example, if I do develop and keep and sustain a meditation practice, and over time I see the more subtle states of mind that I'm rewarded with during meditation, that are always available in meditation, then I can use that same practice in my relationships. I tend to put more effort, I tend to be more patient, I tend to be more open to the times when I'm not getting all the rewards I want from this other person. I'm not trying to get them to give me my happiness. Luckily, because as I go to number two, this is point number two, commitment, which is ingraining, practicing in our lives, developing practices that we don't necessarily want to do but are good for us. Those practices flood into other parts in our lives, allowing us to stick with relationships even when they become difficult. The more we have a practice, the more we can actually stick with people through difficulties. It's really one of the rewards of developing a spiritual practice, that we become more open to the vagaries and the ups and downs that go through. Because if you have a meditation practice, some days it goes really badly. Sometimes the mind will not settle down, but the next day you do it anyway, and then next day maybe the mind is very comfortable and you get to a really peaceful state. And increasingly, you'll note that relationships or friendships or interactions with people are the same way. You're going to have the ups and downs, but the practice of commitment is very, very contagious in the rest of our lives. Now, the second and most, one of the most fundamental is samadhi. And this is developing within happiness and peace, and even more so the practices of sati, which are reflecting on our skillfulness, on the good things that we do. And the reason why these are so important, to reflect on the skillful things we do, on our virtue, on rewarding ourselves for showing up for life, working, putting effort into friendships. The reason why it's so important to reflect on these things is because we all have a tendency to try to get acceptance and support and understanding from one person. You know, we all want it from our moms, and sometimes we don't get it. Or we want it from our dad, or we want it from our girlfriend or our boyfriend or our best friend, and sometimes they're all wrapped up in themselves and they don't give it to us. And then, oh shit. This whole nature of being so externally dependent on a sense of okayness and a needing approval from others causes us to be really demanding and really needy. And unconsciously, other people do things like recoil from that. They say, oh shit, this person is trying to get me constantly to say things that I don't want to say, or try to get my attention when I'm tired, or trying to get me to reward them when I'm not in a good mood or whatever. If we have an inner source of feeling supported, understood, and supported, accepted, and understood. Right? I once did this exercise with this class several years ago where I had everybody close their eyes and then ask what were they looking for most in a relationship. And the phrases that most came up with are, I'm looking for support, I'm looking for understanding, you know, I'm looking for acceptance. And then the question comes, well, why aren't you giving that to yourselves? Why do we need someone else to give us acceptance? If I need acceptance from someone else, it means that I'm not stopping and reflecting on how skillful my actions are. If I need understanding, It means that I'm not focusing on making sure that my actions are skillful. I want somebody to forgive me. If I want support, it means I'm really not taking advantage of the Sangha. There's so many people here who can be supportive. So if I'm focusing on one person to give me all those things, I'm going to be really disappointed, and so will they. So very much a part of this practice is developing a source of peace, tranquility, happiness, acceptance within, and also from other people in the Sangha, but never one in specific. Developing a large support group so that we're not demanding from one person things that they're not capable of giving. So many relationships are sabotaged because we are trying to get the things from them that we should be giving to ourselves. So that is samadhi. That's number two. Number three is upasati, which is being able to listen, to really listen. And this is one of the most difficult tools to master. When we all have very strong views and opinions about what we think reality is and what we think what happened in life is and our version of events, it's very, very, very difficult to sit and listen to someone have a view of events that's totally different than ours. It's even harder to sit and listen to someone be critical than to, in fact, pin blame on ourselves. And there's this inevitable tendency, because we're so dependent on approval from others, we're so external, human beings are so externally based, so looking for the sense of, I'm okay, I'm all right, and from other people, that when somebody says, I'm unhappy with you, I'm feeling unhappy, there's this immediate need to defend ourselves and to jump in and interrupt and say, now wait a second here. And even if we know they're right, then there's a tendency to say, well, all right, I did leave the towels on the floor, but you, son of a bitch, you leave the plates in the sink. But then you, they say, you leave the this on the that. Yes, but you leave the that on the this, you reply. Until nobody is hearing anybody. The most pointless endeavor, the Buddha said, is trying to go to the original fault. Because while we are acting unskillfully by not listening, by not practicing upasuti, which is being able to sit and hear somebody else, it doesn't mean when we listen that we're agreeing. It doesn't even mean that we're saying they're right. But by not defending ourselves at first, just simply listening, what we can do is get past the details of what they're saying, the leaving a towel on the floor or dishes in the sink or whatever, and get to what the feelings are. What is this person really trying to say? They could be trying to say, I feel that I make requests and you don't take me seriously. Now, if you think about it in terms of that, that's a pretty sad state. And rather than defend ourselves, we can say then, oh, I'm sorry that you feel that way. That doesn't sound like it's that fun. I know how that feels. We don't even necessarily have to say, well, I'll completely change. But by hearing what the person's feelings are and repeating it back without interrupting, giving them the space to share what their feelings are, what they have to say, and then instead of defending ourselves, saying back to them, what I hear you saying is that you feel that I'm not listening to you. That I feel that you feel that I'm not being responsive, then you can say, well, you know, even though my views of this were different, I can understand that that's an uncomfortable place to be. And from that dialogue, there is much, much more common ground, because you're actually building a dialogue based on shared feelings rather than the defensive prosecutorial debate that most arguments fall into. Whose version of reality is more correct? Nobody's version of reality is more correct. I hate to break it to you, but the mind is a distortion machine. It does not reflect reality. Everybody in this room has a distorted reality in their mind. That's the sad but straightforward truth. So arguing about whose version of events was correct is like, I don't even know, I can't even come up with an analogy. The Buddha did come up with an analogy. The Buddha came up with an analogy of the five people, the five blind people feeling an elephant. Not sexually. This is not a disgusting story. not a disgusting story. No, there. One blind man is holding the elephant's ear, and he says, an elephant is a gigantic leaf. Another blind person is holding the elephant's trunk, and he's like, oh, an elephant is a hose. And another person feels the elephant's tail, and he says, oh, an elephant is a fan. You get the idea. We're all looking at very little bits of the world, clinging to our views of what happened, and arguments based on whose version is just as ridiculous as a blind person arguing whether an elephant is a trunk, is a hose or a fan or a gigantic, I don't know what an ear is like. But anyway, you get the analogy. So, four is balance, upekkha, which is just as much as we find it difficult to sit and listen to people saying things that we don't like, critical remarks, we also don't like being particularly around people who go through bad moods, who get very angry. There's something about the human mind that really wants to fix everybody around us or blame them for having a bad mood. And it becomes very difficult and we feel very thrown off balance if the people that we are around are angry. And there's constantly a need, I feel it, everybody feels it, to try to say the right thing to make them happy. But eventually, after you try, and there's nothing wrong with trying, but eventually, after you see that they are, in fact, unhappy or angry, that doesn't mean that we're obligated to be unhappy or angry too. In fact, the entire point of balance, as the Buddha said, is to reflect that there's just reasons in people's lives that have nothing to do with us why they're unhappy. And there's sometimes in life we can't lift people out of it. And that doesn't mean we're inadequate or that they're stubborn. All it means is that there's times in life when decisions we've made catch up to us, or priorities we've made catch up to us, and there's nothing that anybody can do that can lift us out of it. We just have to be patient, or they have to be patient, or they have to undertake the practices that will lift them out. Just as in programs like Al-Anon, talk to the loved ones of alcoholics and tell them to detach with love. The principle is to neither reject nor to try to go in and try to fix somebody, but to allow people to have their space to be miserable or upset or angry. And rather than just say, okay, I'm just going to sit and jerk off or shoot dope or whatever, we can, if we feel like being helpful, there's other possibilities in our lives. There's other people. Again, part of what makes interpersonal relationships work is not over-focusing on that one person. If that person is upset or angry and you've tried, go somewhere else with your compassion. Go somewhere else. Find someone else who could use a phone call, a friend, a supportive ear. It's very, very important to take advantage of the Sangha and to develop friendships with other people or just in your other areas of life so that you have opportunities when the person you're with is just not capable of giving you what you want or is just not in a kind of outgoing mood, and you are in an outgoing mood. So number five is comprehensive virtue, which is sila, which basically means that there's this illusion that we have that in the rest of our lives, in our work lives, we might have to be cutthroat. We might have to be play close to the vest and do some things that are unskillful. But I'll go back home, and when I'm with my family or with my kids, I'll be open and generous with them. This compartmentalization of life where is, yeah, in the work world, it's everybody for themselves. But in my relationship, that's where I go and I'm honest and I'm relaxed and I'm loving and I'm compassionate. But when I'm back at my job, I gotta watch my ass. Because they're bastards there. The problem with this, of course, is that the mind doesn't have compartments. We like to think it does. What the mind, in fact, has is a mechanism called repression, which we push things down, but there's no compartment there. You're not shoving it into it. We use the analogy of a closet, but there are no closets in the mind. All you're doing is trying not to look at it, but guess what? It's still there. And if we are in the rest of our lives engaging in unskillful speech, harmful speech, speech that is based on exaggeration or actions that are based on extreme self-centeredness, or that we are simply cutting corners or doing things that we know are questionable in the rest of our lives, if you expect that that will not affect the relationship with your child or your loved one or your parents, I think you're wrong. In my experience, the human mind does not allow us to hold compartments or channels where in certain areas of our lives we act unskillfully and in other areas in our lives we suddenly become, you know, Ajahn Jeff or something like that. We just do not, the mind does not work that way. That's why when the Buddha taught right speech and why right speech is such a powerful, powerful tool, he insisted that we practice it everywhere. That monks not just practice it with other monks, but that they practice it with lay practitioners, with normal people. And the basic rules of right speech, and this is really how to develop virtue, is to make sure that anything we say is not only true, but that it's useful and that we're the right person at the right time to say it. If we practice this, we can still have fun, we can still joke around, we can still make friends. Obviously, those kinds of telling jokes and being lighthearted is part of being useful. It's part of building up friendships. But we know when behind the words is an intention of trying to do harm to someone, trying to get back, trying to divide one friend from another friend, trying to get something, whatever. We know when our intentions stray. So the more we practice skillfulness in all the interactions, it could be with my most horrible experiences, and I never even was a waiter, but I treat waiters. I give them so many thanks, they're sort of confused. Because I've just seen them so abused by people who just, for some reason, will take the slightest error by a cook out on a waiter. And, you know, just practices like that. You know, whether it's with, someone who we normally would not pay attention to, if we practice generosity, compassion, you know, being kind, that in turn will flood into the rest of our lives. On the other hand, if we don't treat other people with respect, if we're sort of used to doormen or waiters or something like that as just being conduits to our food or an elevator, that type of distance and coldness will infect the way we relate to the people we should be caring about. So it's very important to be diligent, as the Buddha said, heedful, apusara, in all of our efforts. Okay. Number six, appreciation, mudita. This is one of the Buddha said that of all the emotional states, we often talk about anger and craving and self-centeredness, but another emotional state that causes enormous amounts of difficulty in relationships is envy and jealousy. And this not only causes difficulty in relationships, but then it causes us to misperceive and take everything personally. People are so dependent on the world for our sense of security. As the Buddha said, human beings are like fish in a drying out puddle, fighting over scraps. And we're so used to looking for our sense of purpose in our jobs and in our possessions that we can become very caught up in the belief that happiness is a limited thing, that there's only so much happiness to go around. And that's not true, because there's actually an unlimited supply of happiness. It comes from within. So when somebody else is happy, we don't need to feel threatened. We don't need, in fact, when somebody gets something from diligent hard work, we don't need to feel jealousy or envy, because true happiness is always available to us. It's so much, in fact, better for us in the long term to actually be able to practice developing happiness when our friends, our loved ones are happy. As the Dalai Lama once said, and I don't generally quote him, but Dalai Lama did say that if we can develop happiness when somebody else does well, our chances of happiness go up 6 billion, because there's 6 billion people on the planet. So it's quite a enriching endeavor if we learn to actually deeply feel a sense of real joy at someone else's accomplishments. And this is done in the practice of mudita. It's a meditation practice where during the metta meditation where we say, may I be truly peaceful, free of stress and suffering, then we bring to mind someone who has recently found happiness or success, someone who we might feel jealous or envious of, and we bring them to mind and we think the thoughts, may this person enjoy the fruits of their hard work. May they maintain and develop their happiness. May their skillfulness continue. Now, if somebody is getting their happiness by burglarizing your apartment or is just a complete crook or, you know, is doing it at the cost of other people's happiness, then you don't have to do it. Obviously. This is not about wishing, you know, Dick Cheney. If you want to practice with Dick Cheney, the practice is the metta meditation, which is simply wishing that he would find, for Christ's sake, happiness within, so that he wouldn't need to take it from so many other disenfranchised, poor, vulnerable people. And I've done that with him. It's very challenging. So that's mudita, and being capable of appreciating the actions of the people we love is also really helpful, because if we just get envious, then we're not going to see the effort that they put in and the rewards that they get. But if we actually enjoy it, then we actually can follow in their good examples. When we're envious, we're actually pushing away and we're feeling threatened and we're not going to learn from their wise example. On the other hand, when we are practicing mudita, sympathetic appreciation, then we will actually have the chance to copy. The mind is very much a copying machine, a meme machine. Not mean, but meme, M-E-M-E. So it likes to imitate. And if we can get past this sense of being threatened or feeling like there's not enough to go around and really enjoy the work of others, we're more likely to then learn from their skillfulness. So number seven, the last, is kanti, or forgiveness. And it's probably the most important of all the seven. I can't go into it in any length because forgiveness I give entire 35-minute talks on, and there's a whole bunch of forgiveness talks on the website that me and Noah and other teachers I've given the talk with. The basic practice is, of course, when we forgive, we're not condoning. If somebody's done something that's really shitty, we're not saying it's okay. We're not getting them off the hook. In fact, part of forgiveness is powered by knowledge of karma, which is that they have to live in the results of their own actions. There's nothing I need to do to punish them. I don't need to keep the story in my head of how injured I've been, because I simply need to know that this person is capable of whatever they're capable of, and that's good enough. But we have this idea that unless we repeat the story over and over and over again of how this person was untrustworthy in this way, we think, oh, well, I might fall victim again. But the brain is not that stupid. The brain actually has a center called the amygdala, which is really set up to pretty much make sure that if somebody fucks with you, you're not going to trust them that easily again. You don't have to keep the story going over and over in your head. Your brain will make sure that you don't loan the money anymore. So all this, that son of a bitch said that they were going to go to my party, and they didn't go to my party, and now I have to tell this story over and over in my head, because if I don't, I'm going to be a schmuck and trust them again. You don't need to do that. You really don't need to do that. All you're doing is creating what the Buddha called mental agitation, which is stress and suffering. And if you've been injured, the last thing you need to do is repeat the story over and over again, which, guess what, only causes more injury for you. They don't even know about it. They don't. You're not that powerful. The Buddha said that in life we're shot with arrows once by other people. They do things that we don't like. They say things we don't like. They don't show up. My mom didn't understand me. Whatever. They get shot with an arrow. And then we shoot ourselves with 1,000 arrows. How could this be? We tell the story over and over again. And throughout that we cause physical stress, a mental agitation. We cause far more misery than the original incident caused. So forgiveness is not for that person. That's where we all make the mistake. We think that forgiveness is about them. It's not. It's about us. It's about giving ourselves the permission to stop telling the story over and over and over in our heads. It's about saying, enough, I don't need to suffer anymore. They have to live with the consequences of their actions. They have to live in that mind, which will be flooded with the after effects of acting that way. I don't need to do anything but to make my life easier. And the way we do this is by forgiving. How do we do it? In our meditation, again, when we have our eyes closed, bring to mind a similar event where we've acted unskillfully. Doesn't have to be the exact same event. Could be something even in the ballpark. If somebody has said something horrible or judged us and in our past we've been critical, just bring that to mind. And then we bring the person to mind that we've injured, and we say, if I've injured you through my craving, indifference, my anger, if I've caused harm to you, I ask for your forgiveness. And you just keep that person in your mind and just ask for forgiveness. If you've injured yourself through drug abuse, addiction, any form of self-denial or actions that cause harm to yourself, bring that to mind and forgive yourself. And then after you've asked for forgiveness, bring the person to mind and say, to the extent that I can right now, only to the extent right now, I forgive you so that I will not have to suffer anymore. Beware that this is a long-term process. The word kanti that the Buddha used in Pali, kanti, doesn't only mean forgiveness, it also means patience. Because it was understood by the Buddha that forgiveness is a very, very long-term process. It doesn't happen once, it happens through long-term endeavor, where we realize, again, I'm telling that story about my ex, my mother, my father, my boss, my coworker, whatever. I'm telling that story again. I'm causing myself mental agitation. I will forgive them because I do not deserve to suffer this much. And we keep going back to it. And it can take, took with my father, it took several years. But we got to a place where we could enjoy each other's company. And it can happen for all of us. So, those are the seven tools for long-term relationships. Just to remind you, there's commitment, which comes from our practice. There's internal nourishment, which comes from reflecting on our skillfulness and on our generosity. There's receptiveness, being able to listen, upasuti, which is very much comes from a practice of keeping the body relaxed so when people say things we don't want to hear, we can stay calm. There's balance, upeka. There's virtue, or sila, which comes from practicing right speech. There's appreciation, mudita, which comes from, in our meditation, saying may they maintain their happiness. And then there's finally forgiveness, which comes from acknowledging that we're the ones who are really suffering from our anger. Once we felt the feelings, we let go of the story so that we can move on. So, I hope you got something from it. It's a lot to digest, but I thank you for listening. And now it's your turn to ask any questions or raise any talks or comments that you'd like to.